Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone. This is issue number 57. I am your host, Aaron, and with me to my left would be Ethan. How are you tonight, Ethan?
I am good.
Yeah?
Slightly sunburnt, but I'm good.
Slightly sunburnt, but good, huh?
Yep.
All right, well, what's up tonight? What are we doing tonight, Ethan?
Well, we're talking some classic horror, and we've talked horror before on the show, but yep. Today we're talking classic horror, sort of like we do classic sci-fi, I guess.
Sure.
And we have with us, as our guest, Mr. James Lowder. Tell us a little bit about yourself, James.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I'm a writer, editor, film reviewer. I've been working in publishing for better than 20 years. I've done novels and short stories, comic books. I edit the Hackslash comic for Image right now, which is kind of a movie-related topic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just wrapped up a book called Triumph of the Walking Dead, essay collection about the TV show and comics that's coming out in October from Ben Bella. So all-around publishing guy.
Excellent.
Very good. Very good.
Excellent. Yes, Hackslash also goes into the horror a bit, too.
So it does.
Yeah, we are a weekly podcast. Basically, what we're doing is we have a long, ongoing discussion right now just about the different film genres out there. And the way this has been working is we invite somebody on. We allow them to choose their topic, and we go from there because Ethan and I like to think that we can talk any genre that there is out there. But before we do that, we have a little segment we like to call Geekly Happenings. It's basically about news that's relevant to us geeks.
Yep.
What happened in the last 2 weeks, Ethan?
I sort of delegated a lot of the stuff to the brief news that I talk about. But at top of my list, really, just arbitrarily, is apparently James Mangold is on the top of the shortlist for the Wolverine director.
Saw that. The guy that directed Walk the Line, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Walk the Line.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, he's on obviously on the same list as Gavin O'Connor and Antoine Fuqua.
Yeah.
But they've started negotiations looking to start filming in the fall in Japan from a screenplay by Christopher McQuarrie. I'm looking forward to it. I've made it clear I didn't like Darren Aronofsky anyway. Good old James Mangold. I liked Walk the Line.
I did too, but
there you go.
I don't know how that's going to.
Let's just walk the line with Wolverine.
Walk the line with Wolverine.
It would just be amusing, really. Wolverine singing.
The Man in Adamantium.
Yeah.
It'll rock.
So is it you don't like Aronofsky in general, or you don't like Aronofsky in this?
I don't like Aronofsky in general.
Oh, dear.
I've seen three of his movies, and two of which I really didn't like, and Black Swan was the last one I saw, and I recognize it was a good film, good, well-made. I really just didn't care about it because it wasn't made for me.
Which ones have you seen?
Requiem for a Dream and Pie.
I think you would like The Wrestler. I really think you would. I mean, it's a nice, restrained biopic. So I think he's a fantastic filmmaker. I liked the idea of a director with that kind of clout, with that kind of talent, working on one of these little geek movies. But yeah, at the same time, there's nothing wrong with James Mangold. I mean,
I'll recognize that he's a good filmmaker.
Yeah.
Talking to Aronofsky, but so far, it's the movies that he's done haven't really been movies that I like. So they're just not made for me.
Right.
So.
Oh yeah, and there is there's an absolute difference between saying you can appreciate something's quality and saying, well, I still don't enjoy it. That's two different criteria.
And with Black Swan, it was like, I recognize that it was well filmed. I recognize that it was well directed. It's just not a movie that was made for me. So, yeah,
right. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he's a very good filmmaker. And funny thing is I don't think he's made his standout film yet. I mean, he's made some fantastic movies, but I don't think he's made the one that, we're going to be talking about in 20 years is, oh my God, you remember that movie? That'll be great, though. Yeah. I mean, we'll see what happens. I'm interested to see what happens with his career and with this Wolverine movie. What else we got?
You want to talk about the surprise cast member on Dark Knight?
Who, Liam fucking Neeson?
Yeah.
I mean, we can.
Go right ahead.
Well, yeah. Zona Ruthos winner Liam fucking Neeson was actually sighted on the set of The Dark Knight Rises. I believe it was in Singapore. I don't know. Somewhere that wasn't here.
The article I have doesn't say.
They saw him. They saw he was viewed in costume. He was viewed filming a scene.
Yeah.
Now,
he's been spotted on set and appears likely to be reprising his Batman Begins role as Ra's al Ghul.
Yep, which will be sweet because I love him and I love
Ra's al Ghul. Or Ra's al Ghul, depending on how you want to pronounce it.
Well, you know, that guy that he played in the first one. And the thing about it was, you know, this was, you know, spotted by some dickhead with a telescopic, you know, lens, mm-hmm. and, you know, they kind of spoiled it out to everybody. But yeah. When that happened, some news outlets went with the story, and they got confirmation that he did film a scene, but that's it. That's all they've gotten. They're not saying if it's flashback, if it's, you know, he's come back.
One of my main reasons for sort of highlighting this article, though, is it lists out this monster cast that is in this movie. It's Christian Bale, Michael Caine, Gary Oldman, Morgan Freeman, Nestor Carbonell, along with Tom Hardy, Anne Hathaway, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Marion Cotillard, Juno Temple, Daniel Sunjata, Matthew Modine, Tom Conti, Joey King, Alain Aboitbidoul, Bern Gorman, and Diego Klattenhoff.
Yeah,
huge cast in this movie.
I keep saying it, and I keep saying I'm going to do it. One of these days, I'm going to figure out the amount of Oscar nominations amongst this cast, because it's gigantic. Yeah. I know at one point I started figuring it out, and it was over 25, mm-hmm. you know, in just, you know, one cast and one movie. So
and it is set for July 20th, 2012 release.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to go see that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
No, I can't wait. It should be great.
You hate Batman.
Should be a great movie. I mean, I love Liam Neeson. I love Batman. Yeah. I love Ra's al Ghul. I love Liam Neeson.
Very vocal on how much we have faith in Christopher Nolan. Yep. So. And how much
we enjoy Joseph Gordon-Levitt. So, yeah, it's all good stuff.
Really, we could see an article that says Carrot Top is done. Seen on set, and I'm like, eh, it's Christopher Nolan. I trust him.
Yeah.
So, also, I saw that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences made a little announcement about their Best Picture category.
That is interesting.
And we're big Oscar fans, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
That the governors of the Academy voted on Tuesday, which would have been June 14th this week.
Eight days ago.
to add a new twist to the 2011 Best Picture competition. The board voted to institute a system that will now produce anywhere between 5 and 10 nominees in the category rather than just 10 nominees. Number. It's going to be between 5 and 10.
Yeah.
The number won't be announced until the Best Picture nominees themselves are revealed in the January nominations announcement.
I think that's really cool. And I like the idea that they have to get a certain percentage of the vote to get a nomination. You know, because before, you know, with 10 nominees, you're just going to be putting them in to fill out a number. Mm-hmm. I mean, at this point, they actually have to, you know, literally earn the nomination. And I think that's fantastic, and it adds a little bit of, you know, suspense to the, you know, to the award. So
sure,
I think
sure.
it's great. I mean, anything they can do to liven that up will be fantastic.
I've got some brief news to go into. I'm going to do some casting stuff here. In the last 2 weeks, we've had a bunch of casting announced for The Hobbit.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to go into it. Evangeline Lilly and Barry Humphries have joined the cast.
Yep.
Those aren't the big ones. The big ones that I spotted was Benedict Cumberbatch has been confirmed as the voice of Smaug.
And the body of Smaug.
Yeah, and the body of Smaug.
They're doing the dragon mocap, which I think is weird, but you know.
Yeah.
I guess I trust Peter Jackson and I trust
that is pretty odd.
Yeah, and Aaron, I'm sorry you were beat out by Luke Evans for the role of Bard.
Well, you know, he applied.
Yeah.
So I mean he probably sent in a resume and took headshots.
Yeah,
and has a
screen test.
Yeah,
probably met with the director.
Yeah.
As an agent, things like that.
As an agent, actually acted before.
Yeah. So he had a few things ahead on you.
Yeah.
So maybe for the reboot in another 5 years.
Yeah, the 3D reboot. You know, it'll be awesome.
Yeah, totally. The 4D reboot in 2017.
Yeah, Luke Evans is not somebody that I was familiar with, and I actually started looking at his filmography, and he's got some big stuff coming, but he doesn't have any big stuff that's out yet.
One of those guys.
Yeah, okay. He's going to be in that new Three Musketeers movie, Aramis, and some other thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he also played somebody, and damn it, it's pissing me off. He was in Robin Hood. He was one of the sheriff's thugs. He was in I really ought to look it up, but I'm just not going to. But he was in another damn role where he was an archer.
Talk about a good segue. Speaking of Robin Hood, Russell Crowe.
Yeah, how
is
about
the father of Superman?
What do you think about that, Ethan?
I don't care.
what do you think about that, James?
Yeah, it depends. Crowe can be great. He can be completely lifeless.
I love Gladiator. Love that movie. Yeah. And I think basically his work in The Insider, I think, is amazing in itself. Yes. So, I mean, he can be really, really good.
When was the last time he was really good, though?
That is true. I thought he was pretty good in State of Play, but, you know.
I mean,
he can phone it in sometimes.
And don't get me wrong, he's dependably good, but he's rarely great.
Yeah.
And
I think it's going to depend on the director.
Yeah, which is Zack Snyder.
Zack Snyder. So,
you know, it's,
there you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm afraid. I'm very afraid.
I have no problem with Russell Crowe particularly. I just think that they could have gotten somebody better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impossible, but they should have tried to get somebody with the caliber and the scope of Brando.
Sure.
I mean, how many people are like that anymore, though? But they could have done it, damn it. Hell, they could have got Peter O'Toole or somebody like that. That would have rocked.
Right.
But... Oh, and Marvel already scooped him by getting Hopkins to play Odin.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. That would have been pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So.
More casting news real quick is Josh Stewart has joined The Dark Knight Rises.
Stop.
Okay.
Hobbit casting. You missed a little bit of it.
Which one?
I don't remember. There was two people. Oh, you actually just did talk about it.
Evangeline Lilly and Barry Humphries?
Yeah. Do you know who Barry Humphries is?
Not off the top of my head, no.
He is... give me a second. Dame Edna. Do you remember Dame Edna from the late 80s, early 90s?
Yes.
And he is going to be playing a character called the Goblin King.
Oh, cool.
I just read The Hobbit like 2 or 3 weeks ago, something like that. And I remember the Great Goblin, and I remember the Battle of the Five Armies or whatever it was at the end, and I remember there being a general, but I do not remember there being a Goblin King.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering what that role is exactly.
Right.
And the Evangeline Lilly role is
it's a
made-up elf
princess
thing. But it's been confirmed she's not the girlfriend of Legolas, so that's good. I just wanted to bring that up, that Dame Edna is going to be in The Hobbit.
Sure. And we're big Quentin Tarantino fans, and his Django Unchained is coming out December 25th, 2012, which I think puts it up against Superman, The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's one more coming out that was pretty hefty. So it's going to be a pretty bold Christmas next year.
Yeah, that's a heavy. I mean, they usually bring out some pretty big movies around Christmas time, but it's usually not that heavy.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking some pretty nasty ones.
Real
quick, Anita, Aaron mentioned last show that the RoboCop statue was not going up. Well, it is still going up.
It is still going up
in Detroit.
Explain this to me.
It's a some people got annoyed that the put a RoboCop statue in Detroit Kickstarter made $60,000, and they started up their own saying, how about instead of a RoboCop statue, we give this money to charity Kickstarter. And that's what, I think it was mentioned on Bagged and Boardcast.
Yeah.
That's what
I got my wrong news from Bagged and Boardcast.
Yeah, so we'll blame them. It's all good. Spider-Man producer Laura Ziskin died.
Yeah, I saw that. What, breast cancer or something like that?
I believe so, yes.
Too bad.
And the last sort of brief bit of news, one of my favorite English actors, David Suchet, received his CBE. He is now Sir David Suchet. He plays Poirot.
He got a CBE?
CBE, yep. He is Sir David Suchet.
Or at least he will be when he's knighted.
Has he
been yet?
He's collected it. He has his little medal.
Oh, cool. Right on.
And he's just one of my favorite English actors. I mean, I always remember his Poirot on the mystery series, but he's great. He's also the villain in Executive Decision.
We've talked about him on this show before, and it was in Geekly Happening.
Yeah.
Maybe he got like a CBE last year. Or
well, he was. I think it was announced that he was going to get and I mentioned it. Just want to say he got it.
Well, good for him.
And a couple trailers hit in the last 2 weeks. I'm going to save the best for last.
Mm-hmm.
We of course got the trailer for Footloose.
I didn't see that. I don't.
God help us all.
Yeah, so they've remade. First, of course, they remade Red Dawn. Wolverines. And now it's Footloose. So, and you know, obviously Karate Kid already hit, and it was actually pretty good.
I like Karate Kid.
So I'm waiting for Sidekicks, the remake or something. Also got Cronenberg's new movie, A Dangerous Method, is coming out.
Saw the trailer for that. That was
always worth seeing Cronenberg.
Yeah, the reason I'm mentioning it is because it's Cronenberg.
So. Yes, he's a distinctive director. Oh, yeah. I mean, you can see his style all over.
His stuff doesn't really sit well with me, but some of his stuff's awesome. Mm-hmm. I really loved History of Violence was great.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly not a numb filmmaker.
He makes
some, you know, deep, biting films.
We also got the trailer for Puss in Boots.
Didn't see that. I saw that it came out. I didn't watch it.
It looks like, you know, does it look the like whole
the Puss
Trek
in Boots movie?
Yeah, it looks like what you'd expect in a Puss in Boots movie.
Okay.
Now, we'll just put these both out there probably as the best. We got, of course, the new full Harry Potter Saving Private Potter.
Damn.
There's
awesome. Looks like an awful lot blowing up and stuff,
so. and of course the best trailer in the history of trailers is the full Muppets trailer.
The Muppet trailers have been pretty great.
And first we got the Green Lantern parody trailer, and then we got the real trailer, and I'm just like, dude, I'm totally into this movie.
They had a singing trailer too before the Green Lantern one.
I'm totally but singing into this movie.
Singing trailer, is that what you just said?
Yes, they were. It was a musical.
I did not see that. I saw the one where they were. I saw the one where they were making fun of the rom com. Yeah, like, oh, is this another Muppets movie?
That's the one that I saw in theaters. I think we saw it ahead of
Pirates.
Pirates, and man, that was hysterical.
Yeah, and they did some singing in that one. It was the rom com setup.
Yeah, yeah, we love the Muppets here on the Red Phone Zone, and
I do too. Absolutely, totally.
I want to be a Muppet when I grow up.
Totally, yeah.
Kermit
the fucking frog.
He's
right there, man.
He's my next Rufus nominee.
He's my nominee right there. So that's what we got as far as, that's what I've got anyways, Geekly Happenings, unless you got anything else, Aaron.
I wanted to talk about the Oscar thing, because I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be talking box office. So, we're going to be kind of like a double-edged conversation. I don't know if that's a real terminology, a double-edged conversation, but yeah, over at our, friend podcast,
the
Bag to Boardcast. Yeah. Did you forget what it was called?
Yes.
I was actually opening my iPod, so I wasn't really paying much attention to what I was saying. we have a, I don't know what to call it, but we just kind of got a little movie, a summer movie bracket buster going on with them, where we are paying attention to the kind of money that these movies are making this summer. And so far, Thor opening weekend was $65.7 million.
Mm-hmm.
Pirates 4 was $90.15. Hangover Part 2 had an $85.9 million opening. Kung Fu Panda 2 had a $47.7 million opening. X-Men had a $55.1 opening. Super 8 had a $35.45 opening. And actually, real quick, Super 8 hasn't been falling off much. It's still making money.
Yeah.
I mean, like a lot of these movies, sort of, you know, make a ton of money. Like, you know, they're opening weekends.
Like I said, that movie only cost them $50 million to make.
Yeah, they got their money back.
It's easily going to make it back.
And Green Lantern, which opened this past Friday, had a $53.17 million opening, which I guess is a disappointment, but it's, I don't know. It's a lot of money.
It was the bottom end of what they were expecting.
Yeah, well, yeah. They were hoping for more, but they've expected it between 50 and something.
Yeah, 50. Yeah,
and so it hit on the bottom end of that.
So on the bracket, we move on to the, after 2 weeks of domestic gross, Pirates 4 is sitting at 153 and some change. Hangover 2, 185 and some change. X-Men at 98 and some change in 3 weeks. Box office, Hangover's got 215 and some change. So as it stands right now, and I told you guys, that movie is going to make a ton of money. But
there's no accounting for taste. No, people who go see movies.
Yeah, and I do want to be on record. It doesn't mean I wanted it to.
Yeah,
just said it was gonna. But right now, I believe, I don't know, I don't have the points. But last I heard, I was in first place. Ethan was in last place, and everybody else, was in between.
Yep.
So, yeah, I got nothing else geekly happening wise, do you?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay, well, stay tuned. We're going to be right back for our main topic discussion about Clash Horror Films. This is our main body discussion. This is why we're here, folks. Yeah, we're going to be talking about movie genres. And tonight, our guest, James Lowder. You chose classic horror films as a genre. And I usually just ask people, why do they choose that? And, you know, get into discussion there. I'm going to ask you a two-part question. Why did you choose classic horror? And what designates a classic horror film?
Well, I picked the topic because horror films have always been just my favorites. Even the films that are more mainstream that I really enjoy. We were talking about Aronofsky and things like that before. The films that I recognize as great, even if I don't enjoy them. That's why we were talking about that distinction earlier between recognize as great and enjoy. They're two different things. Have been horror films. In terms of classic, what makes classic horror? I think the best operational definition is a film that'll stand up to the test of time. And that requires distance. It requires some time. So there might be films now that will be classic horror films.
Sure.
But when I was thinking about what movies to talk about for this one, I kind of looked at it and said, well, you know, if they had been out after I graduated from high school, they're probably not within the range. And that was early 80s. So, you know, I kind of said 30 years, that's enough time to get a critical consensus or a good read on whether or not they're classic.
Now, Ethan and I are at a decided disadvantage because we've done this once, kind of twice before.
Yeah.
And last time we did a... you know, we just did horror films as a whole.
Sure.
And I know Ethan picked
Game Changers.
Game Changers that time around. And I think I just grabbed whatever you know floated my boat at the time. And so you know now we're doing classic horror films. And so I had to find a way to define that. So do you know what I just did? I just went pre-code. I mean, it was really the only thing I could do that I knew that they would all definitely fall in the classics time. So we're going to see a lot of old movies. A lot of old movies on that list.
Well, when I went into this thinking classic horror, at first I was like, okay, pre-slasher. And then I started sort of making the list, and it was really looking familiar.
Yeah.
And so I was like, you know, screw it. I'm going to go with my version of classic horror, and to me it's the universal horror. So...
Yeah. Oh, nice. Okay.
And that's what I went with.
And I almost did that too, but I just didn't want to, you know, just talk about just universal. And so, you know, I kind of wondered if that's what was going to happen. So yeah, I just went pre-code. I mean, that's just, it just worked. And there's a lot of good movies.
When I first set out making this list, I was like going, I don't know if I've seen 10 of these movies. And I started listing them out, and I was kind of amazed that I had seen a heck of a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
And so I started weeding it down and I had a lot of fun making the list, actually. I didn't think I would, but a lot of these movies I haven't seen in several years, I remember really having a lot of fun watching them. So,
well, and that's it. They stick with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if you only see them once, it's a movie that, wow, you know, I know I'm going to think fondly of this forever.
Mm-hmm.
And really the definition of classic could be pre-code. It could be all right, before 1945, or it could be before, like you said, pre-slasher. Sure. But that's, the slasher is kind of an artificial boundary, but that falls into that 30-year thing. Yeah, you know, sure, really, the rise of the slasher was late 70s, early 80s. And there's a great book coming out called Butcher Knives and Body Counts that Vince Liaguno edited. I've got an essay in there about an early 80s film that actually was on my list for this. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole kind of separate, you know, can those things be classics? Well, maybe not enough time has passed.
And the way I always look at, you know, I look at the slasher films, and I said it last time, is I'm not going to discount slashers. I'm not. But I see them as a different genre of film than yeah. just like the regular horror, you know, films. You know, because how the hell can you look at a movie like, you know, Frankenstein and compare it to Hostel? They're just decidedly different kinds of movies.
Well, or even Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, there you go.
Requiem for a Dream is a horror film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So is Showgirls.
For a whole different reason. And I think that the point we're trying to make here is that a classic horror for three people on the show here, four people if you count Chad, is different for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, you say, name a classic horror movie to someone on the street, they're gonna say something different than what you're going to consider classic horror. So,
probably be a stupid kid and they'll say Friday the 13th or something.
That's like right.
That. Yes.
I love Friday the 13th. It just, you know, I just don't think of it as classic horror.
Oh, I know you loved the remake, man. Come on.
Shut the fuck up. I hated that movie. Awful. But why don't we talk about some movies that we do like? Ethan, what's your number six?
Well, my number six movie I haven't thought about in for bloody ever is the 1941 directed by Victor Fleming, starring Spencer Tracy, Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde. The thing I really recall about it is with most of the Jekyll and Hyde movies, there's tons of makeup going on where you have one guy turns from Jekyll to Hyde and it's just Jekyll and lots of makeup. Well, Spencer Tracy, being Spencer Tracy, didn't use any makeup. He just changed the way he held his face and the way he basically his mannerisms and that sort of thing. And I think it worked really well and sort of translated a bit into that Jekyll series that came out on BBC not too long ago.
Oh, sure.
I remember specifically this movie being sort of one of the first times I remember seeing the Jekyll and Hyde story. And it just was really well done. It's in color, obviously, 1941, sure. And it was obviously one of the later Universal horror movies. And I don't even know specifically if it is Universal horror, mind you, but I sort of lumped it in there. And when I was watching
1941,
these, 1941, directed by Victor Fleming.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. If this is unprecedented. My number nine is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the 1931 Ruben Mamoulian one, the one starring Frederick March. Mm-hmm. And he got an Oscar for that. And, you know, that was an awesome performance. And, you know, yeah, he did do the makeup and stuff, mm-hmm. but it was two decidedly different characters.
Yeah. Each time you see a Jekyll and Hyde movie, there is really good opportunity for good character and a good performance. And I think, in my opinion, obviously this one is my favorite.
Sure. Spencer Tracy's an awesome actor. Great actor.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's supposed to be pronounced Jekyll.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Well, that's how Robert Louis Stevenson always said it was supposed to be pronounced. Dr. Jekyll.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we know, and knowing is half the battle.
And violence.
Yes. The other half is violence.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
James, what's your number six?
Mine is actually, and this is one that's kind of, a curveball was a movie called Quatermass in the Pit.
Ah, yes.
From 1967.
Some classic Roger Corman stuff.
It's actually a Roy Ward Baker British film.
Okay.
It's the movie version of mm-hmm. what was a British TV serial.
Right.
And it's a science fiction movie, sort of, you know, scientist leads the way. But the thing that's great about the Quatermass films in general, the first three, is that they're actually horror movies. What science reveals in these movies are things that are really awful and you don't want to know.
Right.
And in this one, the plot is they're digging an extension of the London Underground and they come across a rocket and they discover what may be a Martian in it.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the film, they discover essentially the origins of mankind on Earth, and it's not good.
Yes. I remember that one, and really, it was one of the first movies I saw that sort of had a Cthulhoid feel to it.
Oh yeah,
yes, yeah.
And yeah, I love Quatermass in the Pit. I haven't seen that in God knows how long at this point, but
I haven't seen it in a while. But yeah,
I always sort of lump it in there, and it's just like with the Jekyll and Hyde movie that. Mm-hmm. I sort of lump it in with the Roger Corman stuff, and because it sort of came out the same era, has the same
late '60s,
yeah,
yep.
And I don't even remember if Vincent Price is in that one or not, but
nope, that's Andrew Keir plays the lead in it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that you see Quatermass in the Pit, and you immediately start thinking of other Corman-esque movies, you know, like
it was a Hammer film.
Yeah, and Aaron hates the Hammer movies, don't you?
Shut the hell up! I love the Hammer films. Not going to be any on my list because they're not pre-code, but they're all over the place on my other list. Oh, yeah. I love the Hammer horror movies.
Because, Captain Chronos Vampire Hunter.
Mm-hmm. I was a fan of the Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Oh, personally. Very nice. Yes.
That's a fantastic film. Random Ninja Attacks.
Yes, Random Ninja Attack.
And
it's too bad that was not made into the series that it was supposed to be.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
I love the way that they hid the fact that Dracula was not played by Christopher Lee. That fucking cracked me up in that movie. Such a good movie. But although I don't know why we're talking about a movie not on our list. But yeah, I rather enjoyed that movie. It was so gloriously stupid. But my number six is the 1932 Carl Freund film of The Mummy, starring Boris Karloff, with playing as the awesome Imhotep.
Yep, and that's my number eight.
I like the Mummy movies quite a bit, and I actually like the remake, the Stephen Sommers one.
It's a lot of fun.
It doesn't hold a candle to this. I mean,
no, I mean, it was totally different kinds of movies.
Oh yeah, and this one is awesome. I mean,
well, this one is more of a classic love story, very much more horror oriented, and obviously Boris Karloff being one of the masters,
he's
amazing
actor.
In it. Yeah,
consummate actor.
And Edward Van Sloan gets to play the cool scientist in it, as he always gets to play the cool scientist in those Universal films.
Yep, totally. And speaking of Boris Karloff, my number five is the 1931 Frankenstein, directed by James Whale. Sort of the movie that made Boris Karloff Boris Karloff, you know. And
I left that one off of my list because it was on my last list, but sure. I love that movie.
It's a great movie, and it's one of those classic examples of heavily deviating from original source material. I mean, and that movie made us think that the monster was called Frankenstein and all this good stuff. And Boris Karloff sort of set the stage for what we all think of what Frankenstein looks like.
Yeah.
For now, 70, 80 years. Mm-hmm. That's what we think. When you say Frankenstein, you think the flat head, the bolts in the neck, and that's what you think. And that's been perpetuated over the years with, the monsters and all this other stuff. But and Frankenberry, but, we won't go there. But Frankenstein, great movie. It has what I love about those old the old Universal movies is that sort of cookie-cutter love story that's in there, but it's the...
They get it in there, though, you know?
They get it in there, and it doesn't feel out of place. It feels, it's a genuine monster movie. And I remember being completely scared and having to hide under the blanket when the monster throws the girl into the well. You know, I mean, it's
didn't
still that
scene.
Didn't
he just
throw
her in, like,
chilling.
A lake or
river? Yeah, the pond.
Yeah,
the pond. The daisies in, yep.
Yep. That's a awesome scene. I mean,
yeah,
and it's funny. I mean, like when people think of Frankenstein, they think of the whole, it's alive, it's alive. Mm-hmm. And, to a certain degree, they think about like the villagers. And I always think about that scene because it was a beautiful scene and it was sweet. Mm-hmm. And, it was showing the innocent, he wasn't being mean.
Boris Karloff working through all of that heavy makeup. And we're talking 1931 makeup, mm-hmm. Being able to give us a sympathetic monster that's also terrifying. It's definitely one of my favorites.
You know who Boris Karloff's neighbor was?
It wasn't me.
No, it was not. But it was Sir Christopher fucking Lee.
Nice.
Yep, they used to hang out.
Excellent. We love Sir Christopher fucking Lee. Yep.
That's awesome. No, I really, a great movie. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that in a while, and I really enjoy it. Yeah. So, cool. Well, James, what's your number five?
You'd mentioned... Vincent Price before mm-hmm. my number five is another late '60s movie, Witchfinder General.
Which I don't think I've seen that one.
Which is a Michael Reeves film.
I know what it is.
It's a historical movie where he plays the witch finder. He goes from village to village promising that he will find out who is causing the scourge of witchcraft in English Civil War era Britain.
Right.
And it is one of those movies. It's kind of like Requiem for a Dream. It's one of those movies that is incredibly painfully difficult to watch. Mm-hmm. Price is great. It's one of his most understated performances. Right. And he, the director, Michael Reeves, basically does a film about violence where he dares you to watch it and not feel like you are complicit in these people being tortured by watching this movie. Mm-hmm. It's really a subversive film. It's fantastic. It was originally renamed in the U.S. The Conqueror Worm. They added a couple of stanzas of Poe, so it would tie in with the Corman Poe sequence that was being done. And so people mistakenly think it's kind of tied in with that. Actually, no, it's a historical horror movie.
Excellent, excellent. And I have heard of Conqueror Worm, although I have not seen that one. I love me some Vincent Price.
Vincent Price was awesome.
Yep.
All right, Aaron, moving on to your number five.
It's becoming apparent to me that we're going to have three very different lists.
Oh, yeah.
This is kind of cool. But I don't think my list is going to differ too much from yours, Ethan, with at least my number five. The 1931 Todd Browning Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi. Last time around, I picked the 1957 horror Dracula. I think it might have been my number six or something like that.
No.
And, you know, I spoke about why I prefer that. I prefer that to the Bela Lugosi version. And it just, you know, it comes down to Christopher Lee. I just think he made a more, at the very least, he made a more believable Dracula, I guess. But and I said at the time, you can't discount, you know, Bela Lugosi, and this is me doing that right now.
Yeah, talk about iconography.
Oh, yeah. Know? I mean, such an iconic performance.
It's like that Frankenstein thing. It's like you think Frankenstein, you see Boris Karloff being the one. You say Dracula, immediately you think Boris Karloff with the cape going, I do not drink wine.
I'm only doing fine, yeah.
When someone is playing Dracula, dressing up as Dracula, that's who they're dressing up as.
Mm-hmm.
And Lugosi made any number of just great movies too. It is such a shame that he couldn't, master the language. He was too stubborn to do that. Because then turning down Frankenstein and the other stuff that's going on. I'm a huge Lugosi fan. If people like Dracula, they should be going out and hunting down White Zombie and two of his really, really obscure movies that people should go see are Mystery of the Marie Celeste and Dark Eyes of London.
Mm-hmm. Good thing you didn't say Victor Victoria.
Yeah, that's right.
Or Glenn or Glenda, excuse me, Glenn or Glenda.
Oh, Glenn or Glenda, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a crazy one.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. Well, I guess moving on to my number four, apparently I have a thing for James Whale. My number four is the 1933 James Whale Invisible Man with one of my favorite Universal horror actors, Claude Rains.
Claude Rains is awesome,
and
isn't he?
That movie, I think, is one of the best examples of how awesome Claude Rains is because you don't see him, you just hear him. And it's just, you know... It's the Invisible Man story, and it's the classic sort of the classic tale, and you have it done in the Universal style. So there's the love story, and then there's the monster type of thing, and really it made it up high enough on my list because of Claude Rains. I've
actually kind of forgot about that movie, but yeah, it's a good one.
And while doing this list, I found myself going, I really like Claude Rains. Yeah. Wow. So
excellent.
That's my number four, The Invisible Man, 1933.
Pretty awesome. Let's, your number four, James.
Yes.
I had a 1960 movie, Peeping Tom.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a Michael Powell movie about a kind of a crazed serial killer. It was around the same time as Psycho, and I think it's actually a better film than Psycho.
Oh, yeah.
That's a bold statement.
That is a bold statement.
It is. And, like Witchfinder General, I think part of the reason the movie stands out is it it's about filmmaking and about watching horror movies. At the same time, it is a horror movie.
Yeah.
So the guy goes around killing people using the leg of the tripod of the camera and filming their deaths as he's killing them.
Awesome.
It's just a really interesting kind of examination of filming violence.
Cool.
Can't say I've seen it. So
I definitely heard of it, especially what you just said about the camera. Yeah, that's sounding familiar to me for some reason. So that's pretty cool. Oh, I guess we're going to go on to my number four.
Yep.
Speak of the Devil, my number four, Victor Halpern directed White Zombie. I don't know if anybody but myself has seen that movie, but man.
Oh, White Zombie's brilliant.
Isn't it? I mean,
the one scene where they're touring the sugarcane plant and the zombie falls into the crushing machine and everybody just stands there. The zombies don't react to it. They just keep going.
Yeah.
And the audience and the two guys that are the man and the woman that are touring the plant with Lugosi are horrified. And that just sums up the entire kind of zombie mythos they use just perfectly.
Yeah.
I actually haven't seen that.
I mean, if anybody that's a fan of zombie movies should absolutely check that one out.
I will have to look at it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's been one of those.
Fucking Bela Lugosi.
Go ahead.
It was the first zombie movie.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those that I've been meaning to watch for a long time. Domain.
It's on YouTube, Unbroken.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a great movie. I really enjoy it.
Cool.
And Lugosi's character's name is Murder Legendre.
That's right.
Yep, nice.
Murder Legendre. Ethan, number three.
Continuing on my James Whale Fest, I've got the 1935 Bride of Frankenstein on here.
Love that movie.
And I rank this higher than the Frankenstein one, actually, because of what you actually sold me on it. It's
a better movie.
It's a better movie. It has
absolutely. It is a better movie.
And it's one that a lot of people sort of discount because it's Bride of Frankenstein. What's
Max Norman Hardy?
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's a better movie.
Yeah, and I know Boris Karloff at the time was dead set against having the monster speak, but they did it anyway. And it's one of those that still captures the same look and feel of the first movie, but still. It expands the story. It actually doesn't. It's not just a rehash of the same thing. It's actually let's continue
it's
telling the story.
Again.
Yeah. Yes,
exactly.
It's
nothing like that.
And I love it. I love it. It's
a fantastic movie. I love that movie.
Boris Karloff reprises the role, of course, of the monster again, and does it. With this care and grace that he does, and Bride of Frankenstein adds another element to the mythos that obviously wasn't in the books and. Still colors people's perception of it today.
Once again, talk about iconography. How about the Bride of Frankenstein?
Yeah, exactly.
Elsa Lancaster and with the hair and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, totally.
Good choice. Good choice, Ethan.
Bride of Frankenstein, my number three.
Yep.
Well, what do you say, James? What's your number three?
For the last three, I actually go back to the 20s and 30s and early 40s. My number three is a 1927 Todd Browning movie, The Unknown.
That's a fucking great movie.
With Lon Chaney Sr. Yes, it is. And I can tell you've seen it from the reaction.
That's a great fucking movie.
The premise for the movie, if you haven't seen it, is Chaney plays Alonzo the Armless. He's supposedly an armless knife thrower in the circus, and he uses his feet to light cigarettes and knives and everything else. And he gets involved in a murder. Somebody sees him. He's got a double thumb. What he's really doing, he's faking everybody out. He's got his arms strapped to his sides the whole time he's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who sees him murder somebody. Sees the double thumb. Also happens to be the woman that he is in love with in this in the movie. It's Joan Crawford, one of her first films.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay.
And that's, this is a silent film.
That's why I sought this movie out because I heard that. It is a fucking awesome movie.
And what ends up happening? She is averse to having men touch her, and he's in love with her. So, at the risk of doing a spoiler, and actually, it doesn't matter because. The movie's just so great. You should see it anyway.
Yeah.
The horror for this is what Chaney goes to do to try and be with this woman.
Mm-hmm.
and the sequence at the end when he finds out what this has led to. Mm-hmm. You get to watch him just lose his mind on camera.
Yeah.
Oh, look, he's laughing. He's so happy for us. Oh, you've so misread this circumstance.
Yeah. No, great movie.
That's a fantastic film.
Fantastic movie.
Oh, that's another one I'll have to add to mine.
I also, once again, I believe public domain, probably on YouTube, probably on Netflix, probably $1.50 at the half price bookstore.
And it's The Unknown, right?
Yep.
No, yeah. And it showed up, and it was crazy. It was one of those movies that Turner Classic Movies put into their rotation a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It got restored, and you will flip it on occasionally 2 o'clock in the morning. It will come on.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those movies. You got to watch it. If it's on, you must watch this movie.
Yeah. No, you're great. You're right. It's a wonderful film. Sometimes I enjoy serendipity in the way that things fall, you know, cause I think it's neat that you chose that as your number three, because my number three is a 1932 Todd Browning film called Freaks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What a fucked up movie. You know, I watched that movie and I think about the, you know, yeah, you watch it and I mean, first off, a lot of it's awfully acted. I mean, just terrible performances all throughout it. But you got to understand that he went out and he handpicked out a bunch of circus freaks, you know, and
mm-hmm.
it's just one of those movies that you watch it. And then you're all like, yeah, whatever. And, you know, I get it. I don't get it. I don't whatever. And for me, it kind of grew on me when I was thinking about it and I had to go see it again. And it just gets more and more fucked up the more I think about it. And just like the fact that I don't really particularly want to get into it, but just like the behind the scenes stuff that went on during the production of this movie. What the code did to the original ending, and man, do I wish they could actually find a copy of that original ending. I mean,
yes.
You know, when she got turned into the chicken girl. I think they found a still of it, but I do not think they actually have, like, well, I know it's been lost, but I would love to see that. And I just think I can't call it enjoyable, but
well, and that's one of those movies.
Boy, is it interesting.
It's one of those movies, and
it's off-putting.
The great part of that movie is it makes you complicit in the movie too,
mm-hmm.
because he has real pinheads and real, you know, and that's the thing about watching that movie is you're watching real people on the screen
being exploited,
being exploited, mm-hmm. which draws you into the whole point of this movie with the normal people exploiting the people with the disabilities. And there are sequences in that movie that are just made of nightmare.
Yeah.
There's a sequence where in the rain when they're chasing her around.
Oh, my God.
The end,
yeah.
And the human torso with the knife in his teeth,
yep.
crawling through the mud under the circus wagon after her. You watch that movie, that sticks with you forever.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's chilling. Let's see. What other? I mean, the dinner table scene. I mean, I know that's probably the most famous scene from it. But it just, I don't, is it supposed to creep you out as much as it did me? Because, you know, it painted this camaraderie, this wonderful camaraderie amongst these people that you didn't want to be part of. And yet, you know, you're right. You know, as an audience member, you're complicit. And it's as if they're inviting you into the folds of, you know, their group that you don't really want to be a part of. And it's just, you know, it's insane, and it's a really excellent movie.
And, well, and that's why, I mean, and part of it is that whole idea of the outsiders and everything else is mm-hmm. part of the reason the Ramones picked it up
yep.
when they were using Gabba Gabba Hey and,
yep.
and all the rest of that stuff that they picked up out of Freaks.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that I would highly recommend that people watch, and mm-hmm. I'm not gonna. It's not a happy movie, but it's a very interesting movie, historic. You can't sure. discount it. It's a great yep. movie. But yeah, that's my number.
And
three.
I have never seen it.
So really? Great
that's
movie.
That's why I'm keeping mum. So. All right, cool. Well, I guess we're to my number two. We're mm-hmm. going to go back to my love of Claude Rains. It's actually the 1943 directed by Arthur Lubin Phantom of the Opera.
Very nice.
Done in color, obviously, yeah. and it is not a musical. It's a straight horror movie where you have...
I like the Phantom of the Opera musical, bitch.
Well, yeah, the... movie musical sucked.
I'm not talking. I said the musical.
The musical's great.
The musical anyway, is awesome.
This one is not a musical and is awesome because it's obviously it's Claude Rains being able to act it up as the maniac playing this madness that he can do so well.
Probably you didn't pick the Lon Chaney one. Well, Junior.
Lon Chaney. Well, yes.
I mean, that was a great one too.
See, and I saw this one first, and it sort of colored my expectations and. And,
you know, I think you know, I saw
I,
the,
just, I just loved it, love it more. So
I think I saw the made for TV version of it first. That one that came out in probably 87, 88, something like that. I mean, I you know, I sought these things out, you know, as I started learning more and more about film. But yeah, no, that's a great one. And Claude Rains was awesome. So cool.
All right, cool. Well, that's what I got as far as my number two is Phantom of the Opera with Claude Rains. Great film. Great film.
Yep. James, cool. What's your number two?
My number two is a Fritz Lang movie from 1933, The Testament of Dr. Mabuse. It's a crime drama that it's a sequel to the first Dr. Mabuse film that he had made, Dr. Mabuse the Gambler. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of stuff in common with another absolutely brilliant Lang film, M, which was the first Peter Lorre.
That is a great, great movie. M?
Yes.
Wow. Yep.
And
yeah, I love M.
Testament of Dr. Mabuse is a criminal mastermind who possesses possessing the mind of the guy that runs the asylum.
Oh, no.
Where he is being held. And it's this really great adventure horror film with this massive criminal underground going on in Germany, in, you know, pre-Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And Lang is an amazing director.
Oh, yeah.
And actually it shares with one of the characters, Inspector Lohmann, who runs the police investigation in M is also in the Testament of Dr. Mabuse as well. So that one, yeah, fantastic movie if you get a chance to hunt that one down.
And I've said it before, it's the thing I love doing these lists is I get to add more stuff to my Netflix queue.
So, yeah, hey. I mean, there's so many great movies out there. It's fun to talk about them. Really fun to talk about.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Does that bring you down to my number two?
It does.
This shit's getting real now. Mm-hmm. My number two is the 1922. Must be almost 10. The 1922 F.W. Murnau Nosferatu.
Yes.
Wow, what a movie. It certainly shows its age. I mean, the print of the film sucks. I mean, it doesn't look well.
Yeah.
But first off, you know, there's a lot of things about it that are really creepy now. I mean, obviously the effects are aged and the makeup is kind of laughable and stuff like that. But it's not, what would that mean? 1922. I mean, it's not 90 years old laughable or 90 years old, you know, bad effects.
Oh, and there are sequences in that are incredibly effective.
And the fact that this was around then, I cannot imagine being a moviegoer and going in to, you know, throwing down my nickel and going to see a movie and walking in to see Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just had to have been a horror show. And
especially for the U.S. audiences,
because absolutely,
the German audiences were used to more expressionistic films like that.
Yeah,
but when you translated that outside of Europe. And people started watching it, that and Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Mm-hmm. When people
love saw that movie too.
Oh yeah, both of those films they're astoundingly effective even today. The sequence where the vampire is going up the stairs and all you see are the shadows and the hands moving up the stairs.
I mean,
just, even in any movie now, that would be a brilliant sequence.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an effectively well-made movie. And it's got that wonderful mystique with everything with Max Schreck and how nobody knows fucking anything about him. And they, for all they know, he really was a vampire.
Have you seen Shadow of the Vampire?
I love that movie.
Oh yeah. That's a fantastic movie.
Love that movie. Yeah. It's just, it's a great movie. I cannot recommend people checking it out more. It's, I am in love with that movie. Great movie. I can't discount it. So it's my number two, Ethan.
Well, my number one's actually been mentioned. It's Dracula, 1931, directed by Todd Browning. You know, we're talking universal horror, and for me anyway, universal horror, classic horror, and just an icon. And it's, to me, it's Bela Lugosi as Dracula. It's something that will always, I think, be prevalent in people thinking about the character, thinking about a vampire. You know, you immediately think Dracula, you immediately think Bela Lugosi.
You know, the Count on Sesame Street is modeled after Bela Lugosi. I mean, the breakfast cereal.
He has so firmly Count established Chocula. This character in pop culture and in culture in general that that's what people think of, you know? And this classic Universal horror movie has just so much great stuff in it. You have, you know, Van Helsing. You have the whole
Edward Van Sloan is Van Helsing is fantastic. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, you know, talking about some of that those stock characters Universal used, and it was it's such a great telling of the story. It sets so many bars for vampire. People love the vampires now, and this obviously sparkle is pyres. One that doesn't sparkle. Thank God. with you know the whole mirror thing, and you know. It's one of the things that's sort of hard to put your finger on as to why it's so just wonderful, but it's this movie has really ingrained itself in consciousness of society, and it's like you have vampires who turn into bats and vampires who control wolves and all this great stuff. He has his brides, he has all this, and he just does it with so much panache and so much just this great air about him.
You think he cries at night because of all the bad things he's done?
No.
Well, rather during the day, since that's when he'd be asleep. Yes. He's out fucking killing virgins, and
and there are so many sequences in that movie that are just brilliant. It's, I mean, the sequence between Lugosi and Van Sloan, when they're having the challenge, you know, much for one who has only lived one lifetime, Van Helsing. I could just watch over and over and over again, or the sequence where Dwight Fry in the asylum is describing the rats, all of the, you know, millions of rats.
Yeah, and whenever anyone makes a new Dracula movie, it's always going to go back to this movie. It's no matter how old you are, no matter how if you're a youngster, if you're 90 years old, it doesn't matter. You're always going to think Bela Lugosi in the whole getup. And
well, I mean,
that's Dracula.
I admit that I prefer. I mean, I'm going to say, yeah, I prefer Christopher Lee as Dracula, but it took training for me to think of Christopher Lee as Dracula over Bela Lugosi. And, you know, I mean, in terms of, you know, the Universal horror movies and, you know, classically horror movies, it's absolutely Bela Lugosi. I think that I don't think it's really fair of us to talk about this movie without bringing up the wonderful Spanish version that was made at the exact same time.
Yep, on the same sets and everything.
Night shoots. Yep. That was
and it's on the DVD.
Yeah,
and it's awesome to watch.
First off, if we're gonna talk Universal horrors, you know, Universal, thank you for those wonderful DVDs.
Yes,
great special features, so much good stuff on it. If you can find those DVDs, first off, they used to be cheap, so they're probably even cheaper now. But yeah, it's got the Spanish language one on there, and it's I can't call it better. Because it doesn't have Lugosi. I mean, Lugosi is what it's why we're talking about this movie. What is it?
But it's still a really fine film.
It's a wonderful film. I mean, it's probably better in every aspect except for Lugosi. But Lugosi is just such a force in that film that, you know, I mean, that, you know, he transcends the fact that it's a, you know, a really good film to, you know, like this iconic thing. And I think, great movie.
I can watch Lugosi in almost anything. I wrote him in a couple of short stories I published with White Wolf at one time.
Oh, cool.
Okay, Steph. Well, James, what's your number one?
My number one is a Hitchcock movie, but it's not going to be the one probably anybody is going to think of when they say, oh, Hitchcock. It's a 1943 film called Shadow of a Doubt.
Damn, that's a good movie.
I love that one.
That is damn good movie.
Which is, and this goes back to, you know, that we were talking about definitions before. And, you know, what is a horror movie? Well, a horror movie is when you realize the world is not what you think it is, and it's a really dark place.
Mm-hmm. And that's
Shadow of a Doubt. Yeah, you know, the girl thinks her favorite uncle's coming. I was named after this Joseph Cotton character. Can't wait for him to get here, and you find out he's murdering people. He's a serial.
It's one of those movies that's just really masterful. Hitchcock is. Yeah. It's how subtle that movie is.
What?
And Hitchcock part of it, you know, and part of it too is one of the writers involved was Thornton Wilder. You know, Thornton, Our Town Wilder. Mm-hmm. And that's that idea of there's this veneer of American life and this is what's beneath it. So always stands out for me as kind of a, you know, and it's not what you would think. Well, there's not a monster in it. It's not a fiend without a face with brains crawling around or something.
Yeah.
But it is such an effective film. And it really does sum up what really the heart of horror really is.
Yeah. Well, when we talked horror the first time, which is, you know, not, and I don't mean a couple of shows, well, 10 shows ago, but we did, like, you know, last October, we talked horror movies. And it's something that I got into is the fact that, you know, your traditional horror movie isn't going to scare me, you know, because I know there's not vampires and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I, you know, I don't have a whole lot of, you know, personal fears. And, you know, it's going to take something. It makes me look at horror films differently than it would, like, you know, the people that like to go see them to get scared, you know, because I see them and I think they're, you know, and I just think they're interesting and well-made movies. And horror movies, you know, a lot of times they get the shaft because, you know, a lot of their success depends on, you know, how much blood there is or how cool of a villain it has or something like that. But, you know, you got to remember that horror films are not easy to make. They are and they aren't. I mean, yeah, you can throw 150 tons of blood on the screen and, you know, call that a horror movie. But, you know, to be effective, you know, you really have to do something masterful. And that's why, you know, you don't talk to great directors without Hitchcock coming up in the top couple. And that's why he did so well in it, because he understood that he respected the genre. Yeah,
and I've said it a million times that there's a difference between being scared and being horrified.
Right.
You know? And Hitchcock could scare you, and you can't make a scary movie. You can't try to be scary without being at least a little psychological and sort of messing with these common fears that everyone has. And Shadow of Doubt does that.
You know?
And it's like, well, this is a beloved family member. You've heard so much about him, but he's just wrong. You know, it's just and no one else, of course, sees it but you. And
it's the old Twin Peaks line: the owls are not what they seem.
Yes, you know? Exactly. And it's the, you can't go to anyone for help. You can't do any of this. And it's like, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
When it's so clear to you, but unclear to everyone else. And it's, Hitchcock, of course, uses that by making it such just a great tense movie that he can just do.
Man, we don't have enough directors like him.
No, we don't.
Man, it's really too bad. Well, I guess it comes down to my number one. Ethan, I'm sorry I spoiled your number one.
No.
I'm not that sorry, because you spoiled my number one too, motherfucker. Mine's the 1935 James Whale, Bride of Frankenstein. Okay.
Then we're even.
I love that movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
great.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, I've loved every movie on here. Well, you know, Freaks I'm kind of weird about. But yeah, I mean, these are all great movies. And Frankenstein's a fantastic film. And I love it and I watch it. And it's a good movie. I think that, and I'm not going to pretend, but this movie might have almost legitimized the sequel in the fact that it is a better film than the original Frankenstein. The original one's, you know, great, but this is better. I mean, it builds upon it. I mean, and it, I would almost think that, like, let's say that, you know, God forbid, we live in a world where Frankenstein never came out. And, you know, they made Frankenstein now, and, you know, it came out, and then, you know, it was a big success and everything. And then they go to make a sequel. I could see studios these days trying to remove that humanity from them that works so well and try to make him more of a monster, to try to make him more scary.
And that's Van Helsing. I mean, when they tried to remake
Don't talk shit on that movie, because I thought that was a lot of fun. I mean, it's obviously nothing like these movies.
See, that's the problem.
It's not a horror movie.
It was an adventure film.
It was a love letter to the Universal horror movies. But yeah, I mean, it's what they did is, you know, they expanded on that humanity. They wanted you to, you know, they wanted you to, you know, help, you know, Frankenstein get some pussy or whatever. I mean, they wanted you to empathize with them, and I think that's great. And, you know, I love this movie. And I find it funny that everybody can tell you what the Bride of Frankenstein looks like. Everybody's probably seen Frankenstein, but not a whole lot of people have seen this movie. And I always try to tell, dude, this is so much better than the original.
And it's got much more of a sense of humor than the original.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many things about it that make it just a better film.
Yeah. And it's,
you know, they're both great movies.
Masterworks. Both of them.
but Bride's a better film.
You mentioned humor, and you know, humor's great. These movies should have at least a little bit of levity in them, because it's that sort of puts you off guard. You know, it's like, oh well, okay, ha ha ha, and then something horrific happens. Yeah, I mean, and that's what makes it even more, you know, terrifying.
Like some of these, like, you know, like, and you know, I hate keep doing it, but you know, you look at something like Hostel or something like that, and you know, that one, it just gets to the point where it's just so relentless.
It's an endurance test. It's not a film.
No, that's exactly right. And you know, there isn't a whole lot to be said about a movie like Hostel, unless it's, you know, don't trust foreigners. And I'm not sure, you know, how good of a message that is. But
well, but there's a distinct difference between what is essentially referred to as torture porn and movies like, well, we talked about Requiem for a Dream, or another movie that I think recent that is going to eventually be recognized as a classic is Audition.
Oh yeah, great movie.
That's a Takashi Miike movie, because you watch that movie about 2/3 of the way through that film, you think, what the hell am I watching this for? I do not want to see where this goes. And it's not because it lacks humanity. It's because it has humanity.
Yep.
When you get to the end of that film, you don't want to know why she's doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why she's doing all the horrible things that she's done. And you find out, and that's what makes it awful. It's not the gore. It's not the endurance part of it. It's that there's a human element, and that's what the humor does in some of the older movies too. It changes the tone and makes it more realistic.
And the key thing there is you don't want to know. There's a difference between not wanting to know and not caring.
That's right. Yeah.
And too many of those movies, you get to the point where you just don't care. You've been, you know, so much has been thrown at you that you're just like, I'm shutting down. I just don't care. I don't want to see the rest of this movie. It's just, I feel dirty and I don't care.
Right. And that's the difference between, or you know, any of the David Lynch movies.
Yeah.
You know, and Eraserhead was one of the ones on my list, just simply because that's Chris McLaughlin and I have the Futurama reference. You watched it, you can't unwatch it.
Yeah.
And that's that, you know, Eraserhead is one of those movies.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Audition.
I'm cool with having watched Eraserhead, but I mean, I totally get what you're saying.
Yep.
Man, it's off-putting.
Well, and that's right, and it's supposed to be. Supposed to be, here's a vision that you are not going to find comfortable, and that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's dead ringers. You know, it's a lot of Cronenberg, a lot of Lynch. That's the point of them, but it's done artfully. It's not like Saw. It's not there. I'm going to put you off by making you watch someone tortured.
Yeah.
I'm going to put you off by giving you glimpses of stuff that are going to stick with you. And that's the unsettling part.
Yeah. And that's what makes you uncomfortable. And, but it's not so uncomfortable that you're like, I gotta go. And So yeah, that's totally what I'm going for on this.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, why don't we do our rundowns and stick a pin in this, Ethan? What's your top 10 list?
Well, my number 10 is Son of Frankenstein, 1939. Number 9 is Creature from the Black Lagoon, 1954.
That's a really good movie.
Yeah. Number 8 was The Mummy, 1932. Number 7 is The Wolfman, 1941. And then, of course, we get into number 6, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Number 5, Frankenstein. Number 4, The Invisible Man. Number 3, The Bride of Frankenstein. Number 2, Phantom of the Opera. And number 1, Dracula.
Good. James, did you make up a whole list or just do your 6?
I did. And you know, when I went into this, I kind of purposefully thought that, you know, the recommendations you guys have are all brilliant. I mean, those are all films that are that are well worth seeing. I kind of, like I said, I kind of looked at it in terms of, you know, 30 years or so gives us distance. Mm-hmm. And these are movies that I thought people might not have seen.
Sure.
So number 10 was the 1945 Robert Wise, The Body Snatcher.
Oh, great movie.
With Lugosi and Karloff together. Fantastic movie. My number 9 was Dario Argento's Inferno, which was the second mother of the Three
Dario
Sisters
Argento,
films.
Man. Yep, talk about an intense filmmaker.
That's, yes. Why is there a room full of razor wire in this building? You just, if you have to ask, you're watching the wrong film.
Yeah.
Number 8 was the 1973 Legend of Hell House.
That's a good one.
The Roddy McDowall movie. Number 7 was Eraserhead. Number six was Quatermass in the Pit. Number five was Witchfinder General, the Vincent Price movie. And Vincent Price, that could have been, you know, the Dr. Fibes movies or Theater of Blood.
Yeah.
But those are more fun than they are actually horror movies.
If you talk Roger Corman, you know, Vincent Price, one of the movies that's close to my heart is The Raven. So
That's a good one, too. Yeah.
With a very young, very bad Jack Nicholson in it.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Number four was Michael Powell's Peeping Tom. Number three was Todd Browning's The Unknown.
Yeah.
Was The Testament of Dr. Mabusa. And number one was Shadow of the Doubt.
Very cool. Actually, I'm looking at my list, and this is the first time I would say that, like, the bottom half or the 10 through 6 might be actually more interesting than the ones I've already talked about. But at the same time, you know, I am doing this off of, you know, how much I like them, and the rest of them are just movies that are interesting to me. But my number 10 I chose was the 1932 James Whale film of The Old Dark House. Great movie. My number 9 was the 31 Ruben Mamoulian Jekyll and Hyde. My number 8 was The Island of Lost Souls, the 1930 Earl C. Kenton. Great movie.
Very nice.
Great movie. My number 7 is the Robert Flory Murders of the Rue Morgue, the 1932. Yeah. And then we get into my list, the 32 Mummy, the 31 Dracula, the White Zombie, Victor Halpern, and then we get number 3 would have been Freaks by Todd Browning. Number 2 is F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu. My number 1 was James Whale's 1935 Bride of Frankenstein. But yeah, fun list, and three goddamn different lists.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Ethan and I was kind of similar, but I think I, you know, got a little bit older than him, but, you know.
Sure.
And then yours is all over the place. I mean, there's some, you grabbed some great movies for your list.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I haven't thought about The Unknown in, God, I don't know how long. Great movie. Great movie.
Yeah, the first time I saw that film, it was one of the ones where I got to the end and thought, Why doesn't everybody watch this film?
No,
this is just crazy.
Yeah.
Just a crazy film.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Incredibly entertaining.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah, that was a lot of fun. But every good thing must come to an end. So stay tuned. We're going to be right back with our outro segment. What are we talking about next week, Ethan?
Well, next week we are going to be joined by the incomparable, at least one of my favorite writers, Robin Laws.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
The Feng Shui guy?
The guy who wrote one of my favorite games, Feng Shui.
Fucking Feng Shui is awesome.
Amongst other things, he's done a heck of a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he's the Feng Shui guy.
Yeah, he's done novels and comics and whatnot, but we're going to be talking heist films next week.
Ooh.
And that's going to be fun, I think.
Could be.
Some good heist films.
We haven't done one of these yet that wasn't fun, so I don't see why that would be any different.
That's true. But speaking of fun, we should open it up to James if he has anything he wants to talk about real quick.
Yeah.
James, we let our guests, obviously, come on and shower us in their wisdom. But do you have anything, your web presence, anything you're working on that you wanna plug, you wanna let our listeners know about?
You know, I've got you can check out jameslauder.com for stuff that I've worked on. And like I said earlier, the next big thing that's coming out, and this is probably of interest to horror fans, is that book Triumph of the Walking Dead, which will be out in October, November, around the time the second season of the show starts. And working on Hackslash and short stories and stuff. I actually owe Robin Laws a short story. Mike, you've mentioned Robin will be on next week, and hopefully I will have it to him by the time he gets on.
Excellent.
And thanks again for having me on, guys. This was a ball.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely have you on again.
I think so. I'm looking for, I'm gonna go after Chad with a chair and a whip to get him to edit this shit together quickly, because I want to hear it. But yeah, that'll be good. Well, talking. You'd have to. Well, I know.
I know.
You had 2 weeks to get last. So yeah, whatever.
Chad, here comes. Here comes.
Sorry. No, Chad does. Chad does excellent work, even if it isn't as timely as I would like. But yeah, yes, thank you very much for being on, James. It was a lot of fun.
Totally.
But until we do a show again, I guess that makes me Aaron.
And that makes me Ethan.
Let your geek flag fly. Are you drinking yogurt?